This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hi, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Once upon a time, last spring, there was a little party at Hollywood Presbyterian Medical Center, a hospital that also provides long-term nursing care. Mercedes Vega danced next to her brother Manny, a patient in their subacute unit. He has a tracheotomy, so he can't speak, but Vega knows that he recognizes her, and he perks up whenever she visits.
Here with my brother, super happy. Come see him Friday again. Getting my vaccine this week, so I can hug him.
It was a happy scene last year, but it's been a while since get-togethers sounded like this. In contrast, here's what their visit sounded like last week.
I don't know if maybe we could move the camera a little bit.
They're typically over Zoom. With the most recent surge in COVID cases, protocols have gotten stricter at nursing homes across the state.
I'm trying to take advantage while he's away because sometimes he's very tired.
Is that better?
Yeah, that's better. Yeah.
Vega says it's hard to meet all the guidelines to get inside. Most days, she says, it doesn't feel worth it. But even as testing requirements get more complicated for visitors, they're getting more relaxed for nurses. Now in California, COVID-positive nurses who aren't showing symptoms are allowed to keep showing up for work. That's got people like the Vega family confused and frustrated. Today on Greater LA, KCRW's Kaylee Wells digs into why it's so hard to visit long-term care facilities these days and what that's doing to the folks living inside.
Before the pandemic, Vega saw her brother all the time. She'd watch movies with him, they'd use the community room for little birthday celebrations, and she'd provide countless hours of unpaid care.
I had a whole, like, little routine of, like, help him brush his teeth and clean him up and, you know, like, do massages and do physical therapy and watched, you know, like, put music he likes and stuff like that.
Tony Chikatel says that's not unusual. He's an attorney with California Advocates for Nursing Home Reform.
For a substantial number of residents, their visitors provide direct care services. They keep residents healthy. They keep residents from avoidable declines.
But ever since the Omicron variant caused COVID cases to spike, Hollywood Presbyterian Medical Center put a temporary pause on those up-close and personal visits. Now, if Vega wants to see her brother in person, it's through plexiglass with walkie-talkies.
It seems like when you visit someone in prison, there's like that big window and then there's like huge distance. My whole family's fully vaccinated. My brother was been fully vaccinated. We follow all guidance and yet we wouldn't be able to like have physical touch with him for whatever reason.
To even get to the plexiglass or any kind of in-person visit at a long-term care facility in California, you need to show proof of a negative COVID test. It either needs to be a rapid test from the past 24 hours or a PCR test taken in the past 48 hours. But anyone who's taken a COVID test recently knows that's harder than it sounds.
Well, as we all know, home tests are very hard to come by. I mean, everybody's pretty much out of them.
Sonia Anastasio says before the pandemic, she visited her husband every day after he suffered a severe stroke nearly 6 years ago. Now she's having a hard time getting back in to see him at Fountain View Subacute and Nursing Center in East Hollywood, where he lives.
Even if we get an appointment, just getting the results back, they give us 48 hours for a PCR test. And sometimes we're getting it back within maybe 48 to 72 hours, which is senseless.
She finally got home tests through her sister's friend who works at CVS. But by the time she got them, the facility had canceled visitations because of a COVID outbreak. Nearly 40 patients and staff tested positive. The facility told me in a statement that they're following state regulations. So while Anastasio struggles to prove it's safe to let her inside, asymptomatic healthcare providers are allowed to show up for work regardless of whether they're infected.
We have this alarming situation where COVID-positive staff can just walk right into a facility and provide care to our most vulnerable residents, whereas a vaccinated, boosted visitor who also provides critical care is completely locked out. It doesn't make any sense.
Anastasia says she gets it. There are so few available nurses right now and hospitals are at capacity, but it's not fair.
I strongly believe that it's so wrong. How are they different than us? They go out They're doing exactly the same thing as I'm doing. Why are they making us get tested every single time?
It's called dealing with reality.
Governor Gavin Newsom backed up health officials at a press conference after the state allowed COVID-positive nurses to continue working.
The pragmatism, not what you want, but what you need to do at a time of challenge and constraints and scarcity.
The idea being it's better to have sick nurses caring for patients than no nurses at all. Meanwhile, the vigorous testing protocols for visitors might protect residents from a potentially deadly virus, but it exposes them to another risk that can have equally deadly consequences, long-term isolation. Here's Chikatil.
Visitors provide connection to the outside world and engagement with the community, psychological uplift, help people avoid depression, all those things.
Loneliness doesn't get listed on a death certificate, of course, but a survey from a public health nonprofit called Alterum found that 3/4 of the nursing home residents they surveyed were lonelier in 2020 than before the pandemic. And a group of researchers out of Chicago found 2/3 of the residents they surveyed lost weight in the first year of the pandemic. Chikatil's seen that too, and it's not a good sign.
You know, through experience, I find that weight is often a proxy for health. And when the weight starts to slip, the health starts to deteriorate and people get sick and die.
Vega says her brother has lost weight and she's seen his dental hygiene get worse. Hollywood Presbyterian said patient care has not been impacted by the pandemic. Anastasio says her husband isn't the same either.
I changed him. I did, you know, his grooming every day. I oral care every day. They didn't have to do any of that. I did physical therapy for him. Range of motion every day. Now, you know, he's a little stiffer. It's detrimental. You know, my husband has deteriorated a lot.
Fountain View wouldn't comment about Anastasio's claims, citing privacy concerns. Nancy Klein's son is in a nursing home after he suffered a brain hemorrhage. She's seen his health decline too.
He was for the first time diagnosed with diabetes. And during the time of the visitation ban, he was diagnosed with pneumonia 3 times altogether, aside from having COVID. So yes, it definitely affected his health. I could say that these residents go into desolation and depression without their family member present.
While Klein waits for visitation restrictions to loosen, she spends the maximum amount of time with her son that they'll allow, recently raised from 3 hours a week to 6. And when she can't, she speaks with him on the phone.
When I don't have a visitation day, they take a cell phone to my son, or somehow they're getting a phone to my son that I speak to him for 2 minutes. I say the same thing every day. I just tell him to try to cough when he can. I'll be there tomorrow to move your arms and legs and to massage your head and neck and your shoulders the way you want it.
In the meantime, local health officials say we're seeing the peak of the current surge. The hope is that waning case rates will come with more in-person visits and better days for patients ahead. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, I'm Steve Chiotakis. History was made in Los Angeles last week when Mayor Eric Garcetti nominated the city's first female fire chief. Kristen Crowley's been with the LA Fire Department for more than 20 years, rising through the ranks from firefighter paramedic to fire marshal to deputy chief. Here she is speaking at a recent press conference.
As a fire chief, I vow to create and support and promote a culture that truly values diversity, inclusion, and equity within the entire organization.
But that vow is easier said than done. The department she'll take over has been criticized for perpetuating a frat house culture that leaves some women and minority firefighters feeling bullied and mistreated. And those women, by the way, make up less than 4% of the entire department. Deputy Chief Crowley joins me right now to talk about all of it. Welcome and congratulations, by the way, on the nomination, the promotion. It still has to be voted on, correct?
That's correct. Thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate the invitation.
So what is the timeline here? When do you expect to take over?
So we do have some official dates. The fire chief, so Chief Terrazas, did announce his official retirement will be on March 26th. So there are a number of steps that I will be moving through, which will be a public safety committee as well as a full council. And those will be hearings in which I'll sit before each of those committees. And then if approved, then I'll be officially in the fire chief's position.
Fire chief's position, the first one in which, in 136 years, by the way, in which that position will belong to a woman. How does that feel?
You know, it feels, I'm energized, I'm excited, I'm inspired. I understand, really, this is a historical moment for the city, for the fire department, for the fire service as a whole. So I take it on wholeheartedly, understand, you know, how we're going to work together and collaborate and move the organization forward and to evolve to meet the needs of the community.
We had L.A. Battalion Chief Chris Larson on the show last year to talk about what she was seeing in the department. And she said that a lot of this frat house culture was being perpetuated by certain officers leading fire stations. I want to play that clip real fast.
There are some absolutely wonderful and amazing people that work within this organization. The sad thing is a few bad apples are ruining it for everybody else. Unfortunately, they're not being held to a standard that's going to, you know, get them in trouble. Those punishments are being washed down or not even given out.
What do you say to those claims? I mean, do you agree? And if so, how do you remedy that problem? I mean, the current chief, Terrazas, says that the department has a zero tolerance policy on harassment and that he would put people on notice. According to Chris Larson, he wasn't really doing that. Will you? How do you do that?
Sure, sir. So those allegations and accusations from other women and other stakeholder groups within our department, that makes my heart break hearing that. So if they are true, I mean, this is a tremendous, tremendous dangerous behavior. So harassment, hazing, discrimination will not be tolerated under my command. So it starts with an accountability piece. It starts with, first and foremost, me in regard to how I treat people. It counts with me ensuring that I have clear direction. But more importantly, it's the collaboration between all members within our department that I'm going to be focusing on. And that's ensuring that obviously everybody understands what and how we're going to be able to work together in a work environment based off of inclusion, equity, and understanding how important diversity is to better meet the needs of the community. So we all have to come together as an organization to ensure that we grow past this and that we create that environment that we're looking for.
As I mentioned at the outset, that you've been with the department for a couple decades now, more than two decades. Have you witnessed or experienced personally some of these issues yourself?
Sure. So from my experience, each and every one of us has a unique experience. I could tell you I've had a handful of experiences have happened that I was able to address that person at a very low level and handle it, make sure I clearly articulated that I didn't appreciate what happened. It's not going to happen again. And usually that's where it stopped. But obviously, I'm not going to marginalize potential issues that are happening across our department. So again, it's coming together as a department, utilizing our members' voices and creating that environment. Just from me being in the seat, it challenges the status quo.
Are you going to try and attract, obviously, more women to the LAFD? Is that on the agenda?
You know, the agenda is to obviously go out and recruit highly qualified individuals. And with that, it's a balanced approach, knowing that we'd love to do more recruiting within the community of LA, within the city of LA. We'd love to show and demonstrate that the LAFD, being a premier world-class fire department, you want to work here. And that's part of the strategy and tactics of showing individuals that the LAFD
is the place to work. So the recruiting piece is going to be really important. And I think just really putting a priority on understanding the diversity of what that brings. And that goes well beyond gender, ethnicity, race. That's part of it. But we're looking for a whole person to come in who brings in a unique skill set that can help us ultimately meet our mission, vision, and values of the department.
What do you say to the idea that LA Times columnist Steve Lopez put out there that, as firefighters leave the department, you should be replacing them with more paramedics and medical professionals, since three-quarters of your calls are for medical emergencies, right?
Right. So we do. I mean, over 85% of what we do is medical. I came up actually prior to being hired on with the LAFD. I was a paramedic for 4 years prior to. And I think I am the first fire chief that has a paramedic active license. So I understand that. If anybody's going to understand it, it's going to be me, because EMS has been a very essential part of our mission within this organization. So we're looking at a lot of different strategies. We ultimately, what I keep saying is, it comes down to how do we better serve the community. So whether or not we're looking at bringing in more paramedics, whether or not we look at what is the best model for the LAFD moving forward to be able to staff rigs that are most appropriate to meet that particular acuity and level of that call. So we're entertaining a lot of things, but we're going to be putting together a strategic plan that'll help really allow us to focus on the next few years of where we're going and help us better prioritize and how we're going to get there.
There's been a lot of resistance to the vaccine mandate at LAFD. Is it a problem, the vaccine mandate? Is it one that you're concerned about, that people are leaving because of it?
You know, it is a concern. And the reality is, what is going to be the impacts on our staffing? So, you know, to say that it's not a concern, I don't think would be fair. But the path forward from this is, how do we ensure that we have qualified firefighters and firefighter paramedics out there in all ranks and files that are able to staff our apparatus? So it's coming up with those solutions that make sense so that we can serve the public, and that's what it comes down to.
What do you need from City Hall to do your job? You know, before I let you go, I mean, what is it that, how does the LAFD operate, you know, in a way that, you know, you're comfortable as the chief going forward?
Right. So it's just the continued support, both from ensure that we have the support on the budgetary side, that we have the flexibility to be innovative, that we have the flexibility to ensure that when we justify asks, that we're supported. And, you know, continued collaboration and open lines of communication across the board, whether it's with the mayor or other city leaders and city council. We have had a lot of support throughout the years. So my ask is that we continue to have that open line of dialogue, and that we continue to move forward and be allowed to evolve as an organization when there are justifications for either staffing needs or whatever it may be.
Deputy Chief Kristen Crowley has been nominated to become the City of LA's new fire chief. If confirmed, she'll be the first woman chief in department history. Chief Crowley, thanks for coming on. Thanks for talking to us, and congratulations.
Thank you so much, Steve. I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. November may be months away, but all eyes are on big election campaigns in Orange County. This year, the California legislature may take up a bill that would change when you would vote for Board of Education seats if you live in OC. Currently, the school board is voted on in the primary election, but if a new state Senate bill gets passed, that would move the vote to the general election. Sounds like a small thing, right? But it could have some real consequences. Here to tell us more is Gustavo Arellano, columnist of the LA Times, a regular, of course, here at GLA. Gustavo, hello.
Hola, Steve.
So State Senator Dave Min, he's from Irvine, proposed this bill. What's he up to? Why is he doing this?
He says because he does not want the voters to be confused. This is an election that only happened. It's not one of these things where you have a primary, then it goes into the general election. The election for trustees on the Department of Education, it's a one and done thing. So he says, well, you don't get a lot of people during midterm elections, voters, which is true. So he just wants as much of the public to be able to vote on this race as possible. So hence he wants to push it to the general election.
All right. Originally, when Senator Mann introduced the bill last year, it included many California elections, but he got a lot of pushback. So he's narrowed it now on just Orange County and the school board. What is Mann's relationship to the OC Board of Education? I mean, why just focus on that election?
Because he's a Democrat and he doesn't like the Board of Education, which has made national news for suing the state over COVID restrictions. It is really a bete noire, if you will, of the left in Orange County and really across the state. It's an embarrassment to them. And so Min, it's not really clear why specifically, like what got into his mind. Oh, I'm going to be the state senator who's going to push this bill specifically to get this. So his intentions may be noble, but let's not try to pretend they're also partisan.
The OC board doesn't, and I'm talking about the Board of Education, doesn't actually oversee any school district, though. So how much power do board members actually have? I mean, what do they do? How important are those school board seats?
Well, they do preside over a multi-million dollar budget. So, it's very important to the taxpayers. And again, this is a part of Orange County, a part of the government of Orange County, if you will. In this case, one of the civic agents that is suing the state of California, that is pushing, openly as educators, fighting against critical race theory, basically insinuating that public schools in Orange County are not safe places for the intellectual growth of students. And also, they've also been pushing a lot for charter schools. So the one power they do have is being able to allow charter schools to apply to open up in Orange County. And they'll boast themselves, they are opening more charter schools in Orange County, or more charter schools are being opened in Orange County than I think they said any county in California. So this, even though they might not have the power, say, of a local school board, they, what little power they have, they love to wield it.
Let's talk about some of the critics of the bill. You said the words there that Mann is a Democrat, right, in a pretty Republican district, although it has been trending a little bluer, maybe more purple in recent years. Some critics of the bill are saying that this is partisan. They say that it could lead to greater confusion, more voter disenfranchisement. I mean, who are the critics of this bill and why are they so opposed to this change?
Well, unsurprisingly, the biggest critics are the trustees themselves, and the only people who are really backing them is the Republican Party. So this is your classic partisan debate. Voter confusion, hello, it's still an election. The only voter confusion that would be happening is that you're going to have way more voters paying attention to a race that really, honestly, I couldn't tell you who my trustee is. I think it's Becky Gomez, if she even got elected, because that's how little people pay attention to it. So the people who really care about this, they're the ones who are like, oh, this is our little secret. So the more we keep our secret, the more we're able to get on the trustees that we have. So if you put some sunshine onto this, oh, our party's over.
And, you know, Senator Mann has said that this will clear things up, make it easier to understand. But if the bill passes, it would also mean that the OC superintendent would still be elected during the primary and the school board elected during the general election. That doesn't sound like it's making things clearer.
Well, because I believe the superintendent is Almy Harris, and Almy Harris is not one of these people who are necessarily aligned with the board. So Min's problem is not with the superintendent. He doesn't care about that. He specifically cares about what this board is, the embarrassment that the board is bringing to modern day Orange County, in his opinion, and the opinion of a lot of Democrats as well.
So the bill has passed a couple of Senate committees already. Where does it go from here? What's next up in Sacramento?
That's going to be interesting because, we have there's a supermajority of Democrats in both chambers of the California State Legislature. So it's probably going to pass all the way through. But then Governor Gavin Newsom is going to be the one who has to sign it. He, of course, is very although that'd be interesting because if the Board of Education has been suing the state, I wonder if he has to conflict of interest of it. But whatever. I do not know what's going to happen after that. But at least it will be passed one way or another. And then since it's Orange County, there'll be lawsuits and there'll be more elections and the circle game continues.
The circle game continues. But do you have a sense? I mean, if you were a betting man, I mean, I don't know if you're a betting man. Actually, I do know if you're a betting man. What do you think? Yay or nay? You think it?
No, yay. No, yay. This is happening. and yay also the fight to undo that.
All right. Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, of course, a regular here at GLA. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias.
That's it for us this evening. You can join us anytime online at kcrw.com/GLA. Tell us what you're thinking and what you'd like for us to talk about. And, of course, subscribe to every episode of Greater LA at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Tomorrow, the next episode, LA's Vision Zero is part program, part goal to eliminate traffic deaths, including pedestrian and bicycle deaths on the streets and roads of the city of LA. Well, some neighborhoods are doing better than others. That's tomorrow. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Amy Taw, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all help piece this evening's show together. I'm Steve Chiotakis, thanking you for your time and attention. Have a great night.